The St. George Hotel, Santa Cruz, California. Oh, it was a big palace of a hotel in its day, but falling on hard times, it became a flop house. Many times I walked down the dark, dank halls of that hotel, smelling of old tea bags and urine. The halls, I mean. Get down to room 24. There was a poster on that door, a faded old poster of an old, old man wearing a bowler hat with sleeve garters, hunched over a musical saw. And underneath, in bold black letters, it said, Tom Scribner, musician and revolutionary. I thought, whoa, somebody who knows who he is. Why, that's like gold. Well, that was Tom Scribner in there, all right. Tom started in the forest in 1916. And every place he went in the forest, he took a little printing machine because he knew that knowledge was power. And he would run out underground newspapers in the logging camps, the Redwood Ripsaw Review, the Lumberjack News. And he was always getting busted for it, too. He told to hit the skids and walk out of the forest. Skids? Put this word back in your head. Up in the northwest, they would cut a logging road through the forest, line it with saplings, hook the chokers onto the big logs and behind horses and skid them out. See, down the skid road. The towns, the tent towns, built up alongside the skid road and eventually became the cities. The first one was Seattle. The oldest part of any town is that skid road, shortened in our time to Skid Row. But that's where that comes from, the old log and skid road. Well, where was I? Oh, yeah, Tom. But, you know, when your memory goes, forget it. Well, Tom Scribner was a Red. He never got a pension. He never got Social Security. We lived in the Flophouse Hotel, the St. George, and he played the musical saw on the streets, in the gin mills, and in the pizza parlors, you see? And he became a great teacher to many of us. I could call Tom Scribner up any time of the night or the day. And they only one payphone on his floor. Somebody would have to go down and pound on his door. He was in there, in the dark, lying on the bed. He didn't use a mattress. He was just on the springs, chain-smoking camels. And he had emphysema in both lungs, which is a bizarre kind of courage. Well, they'd roused him out. He would hobble down the hall, pick up the receiver of the phone, swear at whoever was on the other end for being exhumed from his room, and then finally say, Tom, this is on my nickel. Tom, slow down a minute. It's Utah. I got a question for you. He spoke that worker's shorthand that sort of slices the fat off of any kind of argument. One time I said over the phone, Tom, I'm in a debate over here at the Unitarian Church. On bringing back the military draft. They're going to try to bring back the military draft, so I'm debating it. Now, you tell me what you think. Well, there was a long pause. Then the voice come back at me over the wires. When I started in the forest, most of my workmates was Scandinavians, Norwegians, Danes, Finns, Swedes. Most of them left the old country fleeing conscription to fight another dumb European war. Now the wealth of the West is built on the backs of draft dodgers. It's an American institution. Deserves to be honored. I don't have to think about that anymore. It's already been thought about. Well, that's the refrain in this is, dump the bosses off your back, and you're invited not just to sing it, but to caterwaul it, all right? Because this is like street singing. This is soapbox singing. If I get the right key.
And that was the late, great Utah Phillips, raconteur and musician.
Walden. Chapter 4. Sounds. But while we are confined to books, though the most select and classic, and read only particular written languages, which are themselves but dialects and provincial, we are in danger of forgetting the language which all things and events speak without metaphor, which alone is copious and standard. Much is published, but little printed. The rays which stream through the shutter will be no longer remembered when the shutter is wholly removed. No method nor discipline can supersede the necessity of being forever on the alert. What is a course of history or philosophy or poetry, no matter how well selected, or the best society, or the most admirable routine of life, compared with the discipline of looking always at what is to be seen? Will you be a reader, a student merely, or a seer? Read your fate, see what is before you, and walk on into futurity. I did not read books the first summer. I hoed beans. Nay, I often did better than this. There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hands. I love a broad margin to my life. Sometimes, in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie, amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sing around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window, with a noise of some traveller's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons, like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. I realized what the Orientals mean by contemplation and the forsaking of works. For the most part, I minded not how the hours went. The day advanced as if to light some work of mine. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable is accomplished. Instead of singing like the birds, I silently smiled at my incessant good fortune. As the sparrow had its trill sitting on the hickory before my door, so had I my chuckle or suppressed warble which he might hear out of my nest. My days were not days of the week, bearing the stamp of any heathen deity, nor were they minced into hours and fretted by the ticking of a clock. For I lived like the Puri Indians, of whom it is said that, for yesterday, today, and tomorrow, they have only one word, and they express the variety of meaning by pointing backward for yesterday, forward for tomorrow, and overhead for the passing day. This was sheer idleness to my fellow townsmen, no doubt. But if the birds and flowers had tried me by their standard, I should not have been found wanting. A man must find his occasions in himself, it is true. The natural day is very calm, and will hardly reprove his indolence. I had this advantage at least in my mode of life over those who were obliged to look abroad for amusement, to to society and the theatre, that my life itself was become my amusement, and never ceased to be novel. It was a drama of many scenes, and without an end. If we were always, indeed, getting our living and regulating our lives according to the last and best mode we had learned, we should never be troubled with ennui. Follow your genius closely enough, and it will not fail to show you a fresh prospect every hour. Housework was a pleasant pastime. When my floor was dirty, I rose early, and setting all of my furniture out of doors on the grass, bed and bedstead making but one budget, dashed water on the floor and sprinkled white sand from the pond on it, and then with a broom scrubbed it clean and white. And by the time the villagers had broken their fast, the morning sun had dried my house sufficiently to allow me to move in again, and my meditations were almost uninterrupted.
Now we resume where we left off. This is back in Dante Legato's Underground History of American Education.
For the first 3 years of my life, I lived in Monongahela. Then we moved to a tiny brick house in Swissvale, an urban village, despite its bucolic name, a gritty part of industrial Pittsburgh. We lived near Union Switch and Signal Corporation, a favourite goal of exploratory probes among the street urchins on Calumet, to which I quickly pledged my loyalty. On rainy days, I would stand on the porch watching raindrops. It was the next best to my lost river, I suppose. Sometimes on the porch of the next house, two enchanting little girls, Marilyn and Beverly, played. Because our porch was somewhat higher than theirs, I could watch them unobserved, at least they pretended not to see me. Thus it was that I fell in love. Marilyn was a year older than me, already in first grade. Even in 1939, that placed her impossibly beyond me in every regard. Still, as my next-door neighbour, she spoke to me from time to time, in that friendly but distant fashion grand ladies adopt with gardeners and chauffeurs. You would have to see how humble both our homes were to realize the peculiarity of the analogy. Beverly, her sister, was a year younger. By the invisible code of the young, in well-schooled areas, she might as well not have existed. Her presence on the social periphery merited the same attention you might give a barking puppy. But at the age of 4, I found myself hopelessly in love with that older sister, in the pure fashion the spiritual side of nature reserves as a sign, I think, that materiality isn't the whole or even the most important part. The next year, when I matriculated at McKelvey Elementary, first graders and second were kept rigidly separated from each other even on the playground. The first heartbreak of my life, and the most profound, was the blinding epiphany I experienced as I hung on the heavy wire fence separating the first grade compound from the combined second and third grade play area. From the metal mesh that I peered through astigmatically, I could see Marilyn laughing and playing with strange older boys, oblivious to my yearning. Each sound she made tore at my insides. The sobs I choked back were as deep at age 5 as ever again I felt in grief, their traces etched in my mind 6 decades later. So this was what being a year younger had to mean. My sister was 2 years older, and she hardly ever spoke to me. Why should Marilyn? I slunk around to avoid being near her ever again after that horrible sight seared my little soul. I mention this epiphany of age grading because of the striking contradiction to it Monongahela posed in presenting a universe where all ages commingled, cross-fertilizing each other in a dynamic fashion that I suddenly recognized one day was very like the colonial world described by Benjamin Franklin in his autobiography. Swissvale taught me also that mother and father were at war with each other, a sorry lesson to learn at age 5. That the battles were over differences of culture, which have no rational solution, I couldn't know. Each couple who tries to merge strong traditions, as my parents did, must accept the challenge as vast, one not to be undertaken lightly or quit on easily. The voices of timeless generations are permanently merged in offspring. Marriage is a legal fiction, but marriage in one's children is not. There is no way to divorce inside the kids' cells. When parents war on each other, they set the child to warring against himself, a contest which can never be won. It places an implacable enemy deep inside, which can't be killed or exorcised, and from whose revenge there is no escape. I thank God my parents chose the middle road, the endless dialectic. Dad, the liberal thinker, even though his party affiliation was Republican and his attitude conservative, always willing to concede the opposition some points. Mum, the arch-conservative, even though her voice was always liberal Democrat, full of prickly principles she was prepared to fight for, like Beaugest, to the bitter end. For all the hardly bearable stresses this endless combat generated, their choice to fight it out for 50 years saved me from even harsher grief. I love them both for struggling so hard without quitting. I know it was better for Sister and me that way. It gave us a chance to understand both sides of our own nature, to make some accurate guesses about the gifts we possessed. It prepared us to be comfortable with ourselves. I think that they were better for the 50-year war too, better than each would have been alone. Interlude, while the lump in my throat subsides. I remember FDR on the radio, in our postage-stamped living room, announcing Pearl Harbor, 8 days before my 6th birthday. I remember the uneasy feeling I harbored for a long time over war reports from the Far East that played out of the old Philco. I thought the Japanese would cut off my hands because the war news said that's what the Japs did to prisoners. The high point of the Swissvale years for me wasn't the war or the phenomenal array of wax lips, sugar dot licorice, Fleer's Bubble Double, and other penny candies which seemed to vanish all at once, just a short time after the war ended, like dinosaurs. It wasn't leaping from a high wall with a green hornet cape streaming behind as I fell like a stone, scarring my knees for eternity. It wasn't even Marilyn herself. The hinge in all of my years, separating what went before from what followed, was the night Sister and I awakened to the shrieking contralto of Mother's voice and the quieter second tenor of Father's intermingling in the downstairs entrance hall. I remember crawling to the upstairs landing, bathed in shadows, to find Sister already there. The next 5 minutes were the closest we ever came to each other emotionally, the most important experience we ever shared. Booty was threatening to leave Andy if something important wasn't done. She was so upset that efforts to calm her down, so the neighbors wouldn't hear, only fanned the flames. With the hindsight of better than half a century, I am able to conclude now that they were arguing over an abortion, for what would have been her 3rd child, my never-to-be brother or sister. Mother was tired of being poor, and she didn't want to be any poorer. She was tired of constant work when she had grown up with servants. She was overwhelmed by the unfairness of being confined with children day in, day out, when her husband drove off to the outside world in a suit and tie, often to be gone for days at a time, living in hotels, seeing exciting things. She would have implied, because I was to hear the insinuation many times in their marriage, that he was living the life of Riley while she slaved. Booty wanted an abortion, and the angry words that went back and forth discussing what was then a crime wafted up the stairwell to where 2 little children sat huddled in uncomprehending disbelief. It was the end of our childhood. I was 7, Joan was 9. Finally, Mother shouted, "I'm leaving!" and ran out of the front door, slamming it so hard it made my ears hurt, and the glass ring. "If that's the way you want it, I'm locking the door," my father said, with a trace of humor in his voice, trying to diffuse Mother's anger, I think. A few seconds of silence. And then we heard a pounding and a pounding upon the locked door. Open the door! Open the door! Open the door, or I'll break it down! An instant later, her fist and an entire arm smashed through the glass panes in the front door. I saw bright arterial blood flying everywhere and bathing that disembodied hand and arm. I would rather be dead than see such a sight again. But as I write, I see Mother's bleeding arm in front of my eyes. Do such things happen to nice people? Of course, and much more often than we acknowledge in our sanitized, wildly unrealistic human relations courses. It was the end of the world. Without waiting to see the next development, I ran back to bed and pulled the pillow tightly over my ears. If I had known what was coming next, I would have hid in the cellar and prayed. A week later, Swissvale was gone for good. Just like that, without any warning, like the blinking light of fireflies, in our long, narrow, weed-overgrown backyard, it stopped abruptly on a secret firefly signal, on a secret traffic signal. Marilyn and Tinker, Penny Candy, McKelvey School, and the contact with my Italian relatives stopped for the next 6 years. With those familiar things gone, my parents went too. I never allowed myself to have parents again. Without any goodbyes, they shipped us off to Catholic boarding school in the mountains near La Trobe, placed us in the hands of Ursuline nuns who accepted the old road to wisdom and maturity, a road reached through pain, long and strong. There was no explanation for this catastrophe, none at least that I could understand. In my 50th year, Mother told me offhandedly, in an unguarded moment, about the abortion. She wasn't apologetic, only in a rare mood of candour, glad to be unburdened of this weight on her spirit at last. "I couldn't take another child," she said. We stopped for a hamburger, and the subject changed, but I knew a part of the mystery of my own spirit had been unlocked. Boarding school was a harsh and stark contrast with my former life. I had never made a bed in my life. Now I was forced to make one every morning, and the made bed was inspected. Used to the privacy of my own room, now I slept in a dormitory with 15 other boys, some of whom would cry far into the night, every night. Sometimes I cried with them. Shortly after arrival, I was assigned a part in an assembly about roasting in hell, complete with stage sets where we dressed up like flames. As a sinner unrepentant was tormented by devils, I jumped up and down to make it hot for the reprobate. I can hear my own reedy falsetto squeezing out these parentless verses. "Know ye not the burning anguish of these souls, their heart's desire?" I don't want to beat up on the sisters as if I were Fellini in Juliet of the Spirits. This was all kosher according to their lights, and it made a certain amount of sense to me too. By that point in time, although nominally Roman Catholic, I probably hadn't been to church more than 10 times, counting baptism and First Communion. Just walking around, though, is enough to make a kid conscious of good and evil, conscious too of the arbitrary nature of human justice. Even a little boy sees rottenness rewarded and good people smacked down. Unctuous rationalizations of this by otherwise sensible adults disgust little children. The sisters had a story that gave satisfying human sense to these matters. For all the things I hated about Xavier, I actually liked being a flame, and many other aspects of the religious narrative. They felt right somehow, in a way the dead universe of Newton, Darwin, or Marx never did. I carried the status of exile around morning, noon, and night, the question never out of my mind. What had I done to be sent here? Only a small part of me actually showed up in class, or playground, or dining hall each day, the rest of my being taking up residence in the lost Oz of Monongahela, even though Swissvale should have logically been the more proximate yearning, since that was where we lived when I was sent away. I missed the Green River, I think. Joan was there, too, but we were in separate dormitories. In the year we spent at Xavier, I can't remember holding a single conversation with my sister. Like soldiers broken apart in dangerous terrain, we struggled alone, looking for some private way out of homelessness. It couldn't have helped that sister was 2 years older than I. By that time she had been carefully indoctrinated, I think, as I had been, that every age hangs separately, sticks to its own class. You see how the trick is done? At Xavier Academy, scarcely a week passed without a beating. I was publicly whipped for wetting the bed, whipped for mispronouncing French verbs, whipped for hiding beets inside my apple pie. I hated beets, but the house rule was that vegetables had to be eaten. Dessert did not. Some telltale beet corner where a brown apple should have been must have given me away to a sharp-eyed stoolie, the capo who bust away dessert. I was nabbed at exactly the moment dining hall loudspeakers blared the wartime hit. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. With one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Most dramatic of all the beatings I endured, however, was the one following my apprehension by the Latrobe police. The spirit that came over Mother when she shattered the glass must have revived me to set the stage for that whipping. One night after bed check, I set out to get home to my river. I felt sure my grandparents wouldn't turn me away. I planned the break for weeks and took no one into my confidence. I had a dozen bags of salted peanuts from the commissary, a thin wool blanket and a pillow, and the leather football Uncle Bud gave me when he went away to war. Most of the first night I walked, hiding in the tall grass away from the road, all the next day eating peanuts. I had gotten away, full of determination. I would make it home, I knew, if I could only figure out what direction Monongahela was in. But by mid-afternoon the following day I made a fatal mistake. Tired of walking and hiding, I decided to hitch a ride, as I had once seen Clark Gable do in a famous movie with Claudette Colbert. I was picked up by two matronly ladies, whom I regaled deceitfully with a story of my falling out of the back of Grandad's pickup truck, where Dog Nappy and I had been riding on the way to Mon City. He didn't notice I was gone, and probably thinks I jumped out when we got home and went to play. I had not calculated the fatal football that would give me away. As a precaution against theft, so they said, the Ursulines stamped Saint Xavier many times on every possession. My football hadn't escaped the accusatory stencil. As we chatted away like old comrades about how wonderful it was to be going to Monongahela, a town out of legend, we all agreed, the nice ladies took me directly to the Latrobe police, who took me directly, heedless of my hot tears and promises to even let them have my football, back to the ladies in black. The whole school assembled to witness my disgrace. Boys and girls arranged in a long gauntlet, through which I was forced on hands and knees to crawl the length to the administration building, to where Mother Superior stood exhorting the throng to avoid my sorry example. When I arrived in front of her, she slapped my face. I suppose my sister must have been there watching, too. Sister and I never discussed Xavier. Not once. Then or afterwards. The intellectual program at Xavier, influenced heavily by a Jesuit college nearby, constituted a massive refutation of the watery brain diet of government schooling. I learned so much in a single year, I was nearly in high school, before I had to think very hard about any particular idea or procedure presented in a public school. I learned how to separate pertinent stuff from dross. I learned what the difference between primary and secondary data was, and the significance of each. I learned how to evaluate separate witnesses to an event. I learned how to reach conclusions a half-dozen ways, and the potential for distortion inherent in the dynamics of each method of reasoning. I don't mean to imply at all that I became a professional thinker. I remained very much a 7- and 8-year-old boy, but I moved far enough in that year to become comfortable with matters of mind and intellect. unlike the harsh treatment of our bodies at Xavier, even the worst boy there was assumed to have dignity, free will, and a power to choose right over wrong. Materialistic schooling, which is all public schooling even at its best can ever hope to be, operates as if personality changes are ultimately caused externally by applications of theory and by a skillful balancing of rewards and punishments. The concept that individuals have free will, which supersedes any social programming, is anathema to the very concept of forced schooling. Was the Xavier year valuable or damaging? If the Ursulines and Jesuits hadn't forced me to see the gulf between intelligence and intellect, between thinking and disciplined thinking, who would have taken that responsibility? The greatest intellectual event of my life occurred early in third grade, before I was yanked out of Xavier and deposited back in Monongahela. From time to time, a Jesuit brother from St. Vincent's College would cross the road to give me a class at Xavier. The coming of a Jesuit to Xavier was always considered a big-time event, even though there was a constant tension between the Ursuline ladies and the Jesuit men. One lesson I received at the visiting brother's hands altered my consciousness for ever. By contemporary standards, the class might seem impossibly advanced in concept for a third grade, but if you keep in mind the global war that claimed major attention at that moment, then the fact that Brother Michael came to discuss the causes of World War I, and as a prelude to its continuation in World War II, is not so far-fetched. After a brief lecture on each combatant and its cultural and historical characteristics, an outline of incitements to conflict was chalked on the board. Who will volunteer to face the back of the room and tell us the causes of World War I? I will, Brother Michael, I said. And I did. Why did you say what you did? Because that's what you wrote. Do you accept my explanation as correct? Yes, sir. I expected a compliment would soon follow, as it did with our regular teacher. Then you must be a fool, Mr. Gatto. I lied to you. Those are not the consequences at all. It was like being flattened by a steamroller. I had the sensation of being struck and losing the power of speech. Nothing remotely similar had ever happened to me. Listen carefully, Mr. Gatto, and I shall show you the true causes of the war, which men of bad character try to hide. And so saying, he rapidly erased the board, and in swift fashion another list of reasons appeared. As each was written, a short, clear explanation followed in a scholarly tone of voice. Now, do you see, Mr. Gatto, why you must be careful when you accept the explanation of another? Don't these new reasons make much more sense? Yes, sir. And could you now face the back of the room and repeat what you just learned? I could, sir. And I knew I could, because I had a strong memory. But he never gave me the chance. But why are you so gullible? Why do you believe my lies? Is it because I wear clothing you associate with men of God? I despair you are so easy to fool. What will happen to you if you let others do your thinking for you? You see, like a great magician, he had shifted that commonplace school lesson we would have forgotten by the next morning into a formidable challenge to the entire contents of our private minds, raising the important question, who can we believe? At the age of 8, while public school children were reading stories about talking animals, we had been escorted to the eggshell-thin foundation upon which authoritarian vanity rests, and asked to inspect it. There are many reasons to lie to children, the Jesuit said, and these seem to be good reasons to older men. Some truth you will know by divine intuition, he told us, but for the rest you must learn what tests to apply. Even then, be cautious. It is not hard to fool human intelligence. Later, I told the nun in charge of my dorm what had happened, because my head was swimming and I needed a second opinion from someone older. Jesuits, she snapped, shaking her head, but would say no more. Now that Xavier is reduced to a historical marker on Route 30 near La Trobe, I go back to it in imagination, trying to determine how much of the panic I felt there was caused by the school itself, how much by the chemical fallout from my parents' troubled marriage, how much from the aftershock of exile. In wrestling with this, one thing comes clear. Those nuns were the only people who ever tried to make me think seriously about questions of religion. Had it not been for Xavier, I might have passed my years as a kind of freethinker by default, vaguely aware that an overwhelming percentage of the entire human race did and said things about a god I couldn't fathom. How can I reconcile that, the worst year of my life, left behind a dimension I should certainly have been poorer to have missed? One day, it was over. The night before it happened, Mother Superior told me to pack, that I would be leaving the next morning. Strong, silent, unsentimental Pappy showed up the next day, threw my bag into the car, and drove me back to Monongahela. It was over, just like that. Back home, I went as if I'd never left, though now it was to a home without a father. Mother was waiting, friendly, smiling as I had last seen her. We were installed, three of us, in a double bed in the back room over the printing office. Our room was reached through the kitchen and had another door opening onto an angled tar-paper roof, from which on clear nights the stars could be seen, the green river scented. It was the happiest day of my life. Where father was, nobody ever told me, and I never asked. This indifference wasn't entirely generated by anger, but from a distinct sense that time was rapidly passing while I was still ignorant of important lessons I had to learn.
Chapter 5. Solitude. This is a delicious evening when the whole body is one sense and imbibes delight through every pore. I go and come with a strange liberty in nature, a part of herself. As I walk along the stony shore of the pond in my shirt sleeves, though it is cool as well as cloudy and windy, and I see nothing special to attract me, all the elements are unusually congenial to me. The bullfrogs trump to usher in the night, and the note of the whippoorwill is borne on the rippling wind from over the water. Sympathy with the fluttering alder and poplar leaves almost takes away my breath. Yet, like the lake, my serenity is rippled, but not ruffled. These small waves, raised by the evening wind, are as remote from storm as the smooth reflecting surface. Though it is now dark, the wind still blows and roars in the wood, the waves still dash, and some creatures lull the rest with their notes. The repose is never complete. The wildest animals do not repose, but seek their prey now, the fox and skunk and rabbit now roam the fields and woods without fear. They are nature's watchmen, links which connect the days of animated life. When I return to my house, I find that visitors have been there and left their cards, either a bunch of flowers or a wreath of evergreen, or a name in pencil on a yellow walnut leaf or a chip. They who come rarely to the woods take some little piece of the forest into their hands to play with by the way, which they leave, either intentionally or accidentally. One has peeled a willow wand, woven it into a ring, and dropped it on my table. I could always tell if visitors had called in my absence, either by the bended twigs or grass, or the print of their shoes, and generally of what sex or age or quality they were, by some slight trace left, as a flower dropped or a bunch of grass plucked and then thrown away, even as far off as the railroad, half a mile distant, or by the lingering odor of a cigar or pipe. Nay, I was frequently notified of the passage of a traveler along the highway 60 rods off by the scent of his pipe. There is commonly sufficient space about us. Our horizon is never quite at our elbows. The thick wood is not just at our door, nor the pond, but somewhat is always clearing, familiar and worn by us, appropriated and fenced in some way and reclaimed from nature. For what reason have I this vast range and circuit, some square miles of unfrequented forest for my privacy, abandoned to me by men? My nearest neighbor is a mile distant, and no house is visible from any place but the hilltops within half a mile of my own. I have my horizon bounded by woods all to myself. A distant view of the railroad, where it touches the pond on the one hand, and of the fence which skirts the woodland road on the other. But for the most part, it is as solitary where I live as on the prairies. It is as much Asia or Africa as New England. I have, as it were, my own sun and moon and stars, and a little world all to myself. At night there was never a traveler passed my house or knocked at my door, more than if I were the first or last man, unless it were in the spring, when at long intervals some came from the village to fish for pouts. They plainly fished much more in the Walden pond of their own natures, and baited their hooks with darkness. But they soon retreated, usually with light baskets, and left the world to darkness and to me. And the black kernel of the night was never profaned by any human neighborhood. I believe that men are generally still a little afraid of the dark, though the witches are all hung and Christianity and candles have been introduced. Yet I experienced sometimes that the most sweet and tender, the most innocent and encouraging society may be found in any natural object, even for the poor misanthrope and most melancholy man. There can be no very black melancholy to him who lives in the midst of nature and has his senses still. There was never yet such a storm, but it was aeolian music to a healthy and innocent ear. Nothing can rightly compel a simple and brave man to a vulgar sadness. While I enjoy the friendship of the seasons, I trust that nothing can make life a burden to me. The gentle rain, which waters my beans and keeps me in the house today, is not drear and melancholy, but good for me too. Though it prevents me hoeing them, it is of far more worth than my hoeing. If it should continue so long as to cause the seeds to rot in the ground and destroy the potatoes in the low lands, it would still be good for the grass on the uplands, and being good for the grass, it would be good for me. Sometimes, when I compare myself with other men, it seems as if I were more favored by the gods than they, beyond any deserts that I am conscious of, as if I had a warrant and surety at their hands, which my fellows have not, and were especially guided and guarded. I do not flatter myself, but if it be possible, they flatter me. I have never felt lonesome, or in the least oppressed by a sense of solitude, but once, and that was a few weeks after I came to the woods, when, for an hour, I doubted if the near neighborhood of man was not essential to a serene and healthy life. To be alone was something unpleasant. But I was at the same time conscious of a slight insanity in my mood, and seemed to foresee my recovery. In the midst of a gentle rain, while these thoughts prevailed, I was suddenly sensible of such sweet and beneficent society in nature, in the very pattering of the drops, and in every sound and sight around my house, an infinite and unaccountable friendliness, all at once like an atmosphere sustaining me, as made the fancied advantages of human neighborhood insufficient. And I have never thought of them since. Every little pine needle expanded and swelled with sympathy and befriended me. I was so distinctly made aware of the presence of something kindred to me, even in scenes which we are accustomed to call wild and dreary, and also that the nearest of blood to me, and humanest, was not a person nor a villager, that I thought no place could ever be strange to me again. Morning untimely consumes the sad. Few are their days in the land of the living, beautiful daughter of Toskar. Some of my pleasantest hours were during the long rainstorms in the spring or fall, which confined me to the house for the afternoon as well as the forenoon, soothed by their ceaseless roar and pelting, when an early twilight ushered in a long evening in which many thoughts had time to take root and unfold themselves. In those driving northeast rains, which tried the village houses so, when the maid stood ready with mop and pail in front entries to keep the deluge out, I sat behind my door in my little house, which was all entry, and thoroughly enjoyed its protection. In one heavy thunder shower, the lightning struck a large pitch pine across the pond, making a very conspicuous and perfectly regular spiral groove from top to bottom, an inch or more deep, and 4 or 5 inches wide, as you would groove a walking stick. I passed it again the other day and was struck with awe on looking up and beholding that mark, now more distinct than ever, where a terrific and resistless bolt came down out of the harmless sky 8 years ago. Men frequently say to me, "I should think you would feel lonesome down there and want to be nearer to folks, rainy and sunny days and nights especially." I am tempted to reply to such, "This whole earth which we inhabit is but a point in space. How far apart, think you, dwell the two most distant inhabitants of yonder star, the breadth of whose disk cannot be appreciated by our instruments? Why should I feel lonely? Is not our planet in the Milky Way? This which you put seems to me not to be the most important question. What sort of space is that which separates a man from his fellows? and makes him solitary. I have found that no exertion of the legs can bring two minds much nearer to one another. What do we want most to dwell near to? Not to many men, surely. The depot, the post office, the bar room, the meeting house, the schoolhouse, the grocery, Beacon Hill, or the Five Points, where men most congregate. But to the perennial source of our life, whence in all our experience we have found that to issue, as the willow stands near the water and sends out its roots in that direction, this will vary with different natures, but this is the place where a wise man will dig his cellar. I one evening overtook one of my townsmen who has accumulated what is called a handsome property, though I never got a fair view of it, on the Walden Road, driving a pair of cattle to market, who inquired of me how I could bring my mind to give up so many of the comforts of life. I answered that I was very sure I liked it passably well. I was not joking. And so I went home to my bed, and left him to pick his way through the darkness and the mud to Brighton, or Bright Town, which place he would reach some time in the morning. Any prospect of awakening or coming to life to a dead man makes indifferent all times and places. The place where that may occur is always the same, and indescribably pleasant to all our senses. For the most part, we allow only outlying and transient circumstances to make our occasions. They are, in fact, the cause of our distraction. Nearest to all things is that power which fashions their being. Next to us, the grandest laws are continually being executed. Next to us is not the workman whom we have hired, with whom we love so well to talk, but the workman whose work we are. How vast and profound is the influence of the subtle powers of heaven and of earth. We seek to perceive them, and we do not see them. We seek to hear them, and we do not hear them. Identified with the substance of things, they cannot be separated from them. They cause that in all the universe men purify and sanctify their hearts, and clothe themselves in their holiday garments to offer sacrifices and oblations to their ancestors. It is an ocean of subtle intelligences. They are everywhere, above us, on our left, on our right. They environ us on all sides. We are the subjects of an experiment which is not a little interesting to me. Can we not do without the society of our gossips a little while under these circumstances? Have our own thoughts to cheer us? Confucius says truly, "Virtue does not remain as an abandoned orphan. It must of necessity have neighbors." With thinking, we may be beside ourselves in a sane sense. By a conscious effort of the mind, we can stand aloof from actions and their consequences, and all things, good and bad, go by us like a torrent. We are not wholly involved in nature. I may be either the driftwood in the stream, or Indra in the sky looking down on it. I may be affected by a theatrical exhibition. On the other hand, I may not be affected by an actual event which appears to concern me much more. I only know myself as a human entity, the scene, so to speak, of thoughts and affections, and am sensible of a certain doubleness by which I can stand as remote from myself as from another. However intense my experience, I am conscious of the presence and criticism of a part of me, which, as it were, is not a part of me, but spectator, sharing no experience, but taking note of it. And that is no more I than it is you. When the play, it may be the tragedy, of life is over, the spectator goes his way. It was a kind of fiction, a work of the imagination only, so far as he was concerned. This doubleness may easily make us poor neighbors and friends sometimes.
And on that enigmatic and transcendental note, we conclude our reading from Walden this week. If you're a new listener to the show and you haven't familiarized yourself with Charles Eisenstein's very important ideas about transcending the discrete and the separate self, then you may wish to check out The Ascent of Humanity, an audiobook produced by myself and Lynn Gerry, which is available for download from our website. That would be at unwelcomeguests.net/audiobooks. And the entirety of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education is also available as an audiobook on that page. If you'd like to download this show, it has a webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/646. If you'd like to download any previous shows, you can do so at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed if you'd like to subscribe, be informed of new episodes, twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. And there's a mailing list if you broadcast the show on your station, or if you'd like to volunteer to make an episode. I hope you enjoyed this episode, quite a contrast from last week, and yet I hope you can see the connection between the two. The way in which the edifice of global capitalism, so dependent on the ideas of the discrete and separate self, relies upon people's erosion, morally, spiritually, intellectually, and their replacement by something approximating a machine. So, I hope this show has given you inspiration to follow your genius, to learn from being lazy, and to give all the love you can to the universe around you in whatever ways your genius directs.